That's a humbling way to start things out. Thanks, Brett. Dang. I'm not going to live up to that picture you've just painted. Today we're going to talk about the life of Judah. And this is Judah, who is the son of Jacob. He's the grandson of Isaac. He's the great-grandson of Abraham, who we know is the father of the Israelite nation. And to understand Judah's story, I think we need to understand a little bit about what his family life was like, because this is what formed him. And it's going to tell us a lot about who he was. And to find out the story of his parents, you go to Genesis chapters 29 and 30. If you got your Bibles with you, you can turn to Genesis 29 and 30. We do not have the time here today for me to read through these entire chapters. So if you want to follow along and fact check me as we go, you know, just to make sure that I'm saying this like it's supposed to be said, you can do that. But we're going to look at this story. And if you've never read through this entire story before, please do so later. It's a wild one. It really is. So Jacob, who is the son of Isaac, he travels to his uncle Laban's territory in search for a wife. That's what he's doing. So he shows up there, and as he's looking around for this wife, he falls in love with his cousin. That's who he falls in love with, this lady named Rachel. And before you get too judgy, these are different times, all right? Not a whole lot of options out in the middle of the desert. So he goes to his uncle Laban. He says, "Hey, I'm in love with your daughter, Rachel. I would like to marry her." And Laban says, "Okay, let's work out a deal here. If you work for 7 years, I will allow you to marry my daughter." And so Jacob agrees, and the romance continues on. It's this beautiful picture. The Bible actually tells us that it just seems like these 7 years were just a couple of days, you know, because he is so in love. Jacob's so in love with this woman, and it's like, you know, this is one of those, let's do a collective awe. This is an awe moment. Can we do it? Oh, I mean, this is sappier than The Fault in Our Stars. I mean, right here. It really is. But the sappiness ends there, and the weirdness begins after the 7 years are up. If you guys are familiar with the story, 7 years are up. Jacob goes to Laban and says, "Hey, Laban, I've worked for 7 years. I am ready to consummate this marriage. Let's get this party started." And so Laban throws this huge party, you know, this wedding feast. And at the end of the party, Jacob goes off to the marriage tent, and Laban sends his daughter also to the marriage tent. Now, I don't know if Jacob had partied a little too hard that night, or if she had a veil on the entire time, or if it was just really dark the entire time in the tent. But in the morning, when he wakes up, opens his eyes, and looks across at his bride, it's not Rachel. It turns out he has actually consummated the marriage and married Rachel's older sister, Leah. You know, so the romantic stuff, dead and gone. I mean, the dad has switched brides on him. This is crazy stuff. He's obviously ticked off. He goes to Laban, and he said, "Well, Laban, what's the deal here? I worked 7 years to marry Rachel. Rachel, what are you doing here?" And Laban says, I mean, totally unapologetic, "Hey, in this country, the older sister always gets married off first, so I married her off to you. Now, if you want to work another 7 years, you can do that, and I will allow you to marry Rachel as well." And so that's exactly what he does. This is a dedicated man. He works another 7 years to marry Rachel, and he ends up married to sisters, Leah and Rachel, who are sisters, and he only loves, the Bible is very clear about this, he only loves Rachel. And this is where things get really crazy, if that wasn't crazy enough for you already, because Jacob, visibly, he does not treat Leah well in front of the family. He does not treat her well. And because of that, God makes it so Leah is the only one of the two women that can have children. And she gives Jacob four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And we have a little, just so that you can follow around. This gets nuts. So here, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah is who she is able to give him, four sons. And Leah, who cannot have children right now, and Rachel, who cannot have children right now, does the only rational thing that she could possibly do. She sends her handservant, Bilhah, to have sex with her husband. And then when she gets pregnant, she is going to raise those children as her own. So those bring the next two boys into crazy town. That's Dan and Naphtali. Now, at this point, Leah, who had the first set of sons, she has stopped having children. So she decides to crank the craziness factor up to 11. And she sends her own handservant, Zilpah, to have sex with her husband. And she also has two sons. That's the next thing down in the list. And during this time, Jacob has actually stopped giving Leah any sort of physical affection at all. And so Leah goes to Rachel and works out a deal. "Hey, I'll give you some mandrakes that my oldest son Reuben has picked if you will allow me to sleep with my own husband." I mean, that's the deal that they work out. And so for paying for sex with her own husband, Leah is able to get pregnant again, and she has two more sons, Issachar and Zebulun. Now, after all this stuff is going down, finally, Rachel is able to get pregnant herself, and she gives birth to probably the most famous of the two sons. This is Joseph and Benjamin. And as you guys can probably guess, there's some pretty serious fallout that comes from this twisted family dynamic that they got going on here. Yeah, and yes, Jacob was tricked into marrying Leah, but you know what? That doesn't make it okay that he visibly treats her terrible in front of the rest of the family. And because that's going on, Leah chooses to kind of name her children, give her children these names that are digs at her sister Rachel. Have you guys heard this stuff before? Her son Reuben, his name actually means, see, a son. So anytime Reuben's running around out there and Rachel looks at him, all she hears is, see, a son, see, a son. I mean, like, that's what his name means to her. It's exactly what it means. Levi means heard, and she is telling the world, hey, God has heard my prayers. He's given me a son. You haven't been able to give him a son? Sorry about that. That's what their names mean. Zebulun means to honor. And again, she's sending this message, God has honored me and not you. This is the stuff that's going on between these two sisters in this family. There's some extreme cruelty going on back and forth between them, and this is the environment that our boy Judah grew up in. This is where he grew up. He was the fourth son of a woman who was not loved by her husband, and when Rachel finally does give birth to a boy, Jacob's 11th son, he automatically becomes the favorite. He loves Joseph more than any of the other sons that has come before him. He treats him differently. He loves him better. He gives him gifts that he won't give to anybody else. And this toxic family environment that Judah is a part of leaves some really deep wounds in Judah. And we can see this as his story plays out later throughout his life. So let's fast forward to Genesis chapter 37. Again, you can turn there if you want to. Joseph is now the favorite son of his father. He's the favorite son of all, and he's not well liked by his brothers for obvious reasons, because he's obviously the favorite son. And he does himself no favors by coming to all his other brothers and saying, hey, God sent me this vision, and basically all you guys are going to bow down to me and honor me. So I just want to throw that out there, let you guys know. And while this vision was prophetic, this is something that comes true in his life, in the life of Joseph, as we know. I mean, this is one of those things, it's like, hey, Joseph, maybe keep that one on the DL. You know, it's like, keep that one to yourself, because really this was the straw that broke the camel's back for the brothers. From this point forward, I mean, there's just nothing but absolute hatred for Joseph in their hearts. So they're out watching the sheep, doing the shepherd thing. Guess where Joseph is? He's back at camp, doing all the easy jobs, hanging out with dad. And Jacob brings Joseph in. He says, hey, I want you to go check up on your brothers. Just make sure those idiots are doing what they're supposed to be doing. So Joseph goes out to check on his brothers. And when the brothers see him coming from afar, they decide, hey, now is the time. Now is the time for us to do something about this little brother that we hate so much. We can get rid of him once and for all. So Judah and his other brothers decide they're going to kill Joseph. That's their decision. Now, fortunately, Reuben, the oldest brother of all, he grows a conscience and says, hey, we don't want our brother's blood on our hands, so let's do this instead. Let's grab him and throw him down in the bottom of this empty well. You know, he's a much, much nicer guy. But see, secretly what Reuben's doing is, in his head, he's thinking, when the other brothers leave, I'm going to sneak back, save Joseph, and then I can show up to dad. Hey, look who's the hero. Look who saved your favorite son. And so he can earn some of his father's love. Again, there's this weird dynamic going on in their family. And so Joseph shows up, hey guys, what's going on? They grab him, beat him, strip him, throw him into the bottom of a well, and apparently, kidnapping and beating your brother works up a bit of an appetite, because they just immediately sit down, like, and start eating lunch. He's, hey guys, oh man, these crackers are delicious. That's what's going on. So they're eating lunch, and Judah looks up, and off in the distance, he sees this caravan coming over the horizon. He says, hey guys, there's no money to be made in killing Joseph. Let's sell him as a slave to these caravan traders. And this ruins Reuben's plan to come back later and look like the hero. But it's Judah, the guy that we're talking about, that leads the way in selling his own brother into slavery. And then they go back to their father Jacob. Hey, Dad, sorry, Joseph got torn apart by wild animals. And they just go on living their life like nothing ever happened. You guys think Judah's got some emotional wounds that he's dealing with? Anybody? Yeah, I think so. So fast forward a few more years, and we're on to Genesis chapter 38. Now, for the Joseph part of the story, this is the part of the story we know a lot better. Joseph has been sold into slavery in Egypt to the captain of Pharaoh's guard. So while that's going on in Egypt, Judah himself has reached marrying age. But he's still dragging around, like, the woundedness of his past with him. So he goes against the wishes of his family, because he's a rebel. He's a rebel, and he marries this Canaanite woman who would have worshipped false pagan gods. Judah just lives out his rebellion, this rebellion from his wounds, all the time. And so he and his Canaanite wife, they have three boys, Onan, and Shelah. These are the three boys that they have. Now, when is old enough, Judah marries him off to a woman named Tamar. And for those of you, since you guys are all like Bible scholars here, you may know this is the same Tamar that comes from the lineage of Jesus in the Gospels. This is that same Tamar. And because you guys know basically everything about the Bible, now that you're here at DCC, you might be asking yourself, hey, wait a second. In the lineage of Jesus, doesn't it say that Judah is the father of Tamar's kids and not her husband Ur? What's going on there? That's the question you might ask. And it's a great question because this is a pretty crazy part of the story that goes on here. What happens is Judah marries off his son Ur to Tamar, and Ur dies before he is able to give Tamar a child. And in the ancient world, in the ancient world, especially in these nomadic desert cultures, women basically had zero power. Zero property, zero ability to take care of themselves. And so basically, if a woman was alive, she was under the care of her dad when she was young. And then when she got married, she was under the care of her husband. And then when she was older, she was supposed to be under the care of her sons. This is the way that it worked. Tamar had lost her husband, and she had no son. So basically, she had no future in these ancient times. And situations like this is exactly why the Hebrews practiced something that they called levirate marriage. And levirate marriage is where the brother of a deceased man will marry his dead brother's wife. And so Onan and Tamar are supposed to get married according to levirate marriage. And now here it gets even crazier than that. So not only do they get married, but the first child, the first son that they have together would actually be considered Ur's son, so that Ur's name can continue on and so that his legacy can continue. The first son that was born to the new couple, that'd be his brother's son. So in this situation, when Ur died, Onan's responsibility was to marry Tamar and have children with her, though the first son, again, would be considered the son of Ur. But Onan didn't like the idea of making a child with this woman that would not be his. So you know what he does? He has all the fun he wants with his new wife and sleeps with her and has sex with her, but he refuses to get her pregnant. You can read about how he pulls that off in your own version of the readings yourself. I'm not going to explain that for you. But, I mean, when you look at Onan, that's a pretty wicked and selfish mentality he has, isn't it? Okay, so he's willing to have all the fun he wants with this woman, but he's not going to honor his wife in any way, and he's not going to honor his deceased brother. That's what's going on. And things continue to spiral out of the control. Bam, Onan dies. So he dies without giving Tamar a child, and now it's Shelah's turn to step up according to levirate custom. But Judah does not like this idea. He's basically looking at Tamar as like the black widow woman. Every one of his sons that he has married off to her is now dead. He wants nothing to do with marrying Shelah off to Tamar, and so he refuses to make this happen. And this puts Tamar in a bad spot, doesn't it? Puts her in a bad spot. She's got no options. She's got no future. She has been wronged by her father-in-law, and she doesn't know where to turn. So you know what she does? What any self-respecting young woman would do, she dresses up like a temple prostitute and stands on the side of the road and waits for her father-in-law to walk by so that he can impregnate her. That's her plan. That is her plan. Now, while dressing up like a prostitute and waiting on the side of the road to be impregnated by your father-in-law may seem like a terrible and insane idea, she really had no other options. Now, this is a man that refused to give her the justice that she deserved, and so she was doing what she had to do in these ancient times to fight for her justice. The other fact of the matter here is this. If Judah was a man of honor, what would he have done when he sees a prostitute on the side of the road? Walked on by, right? That's what men of honor do. So if he had been a man of honor, that's exactly what he would have done. But who is Judah? He's a rebel, right? I mean, his dad didn't love him like his dad was supposed to, so he's got these wounds, he's got these hurts, so Judah does what he wants. So if he sees a hot prostitute on the side of the road, he's sleeping with her, because that's what he wants to do. Tamar knows the kind of guy that Judah is, and she uses that to her advantage. So Judah sleeps with Tamar, he gets her pregnant. Judah has some serious issues with life choices, doesn't he? He really does. You know, I once heard a speaker, this is a Christian counselor named Larry Crabb, talk about something that he called the wounded life. And I think Judah fits the bill for a man who is living right smack dab in the middle of the wounded life. And yeah, it's true. Judah was born into a messed up family, wasn't he? I mean, he felt neglected by his dad. He grew up in the midst of this hate-filled tension between his mom and his stepmom slash aunt as they're throwing cruelty back and forth. He watched as his dad, right in front of his eyes, placed favorites, you know, right in front of all the other boys. And again, he is the fourth son of an unloved mother, so he's basically an afterthought to his father. That's who Judah is. But the reality is this, that Judah made the choice to let his upbringing define who he was going to become. That's the choice that he made. Instead of working towards growth and healing and forgiveness, he chose to live right there in the middle of the wounded life. The life and the wounded life is absolutely caught up in and directed by the wounds that other people had given to him. Judah allowed his identity to be formed by the hurts that other people had given him, and that is the definition of the wounded life. Right there, that's the wounded life. Now, I remember an early hurt that I experienced in my own life that kind of sent me spiraling into the wounded life. I'm 37 years old now, and this is something that happened to me when I was 11 years old. And as I stand up here in front of you, it sounds kind of ridiculous to even be talking about this. It sounds so insignificant, but this is something that truly had a significant impact on my life. All through elementary school, I was just kind of an average-sized kid. In fact, you'd probably better describe me as scrawny. This is me. Do you like those short shorts? Ow! So this is 1980s soccer-playing Brandon. I was a scrawny kid, you know, compared to other people. That's how I was when I was growing up, skin and bones. But the summer after fifth grade, you know, I actually kind of chunked out a little bit. I think we got a picture of this one, too. I put on a little weight, so this is a couple years later. You know, I'd gone from skinny to a little bit chunky, and I don't know if it was the Nintendo Entertainment System that I got, and I was playing Super Mario Brothers all summer and eating junk food, or if it was the fact that my body was, like, storing up some energy for that wonderful phase of life known as puberty. You know, I don't know what was going on, but I got a little chubby. I chunked out a little bit, but the thing is, and you guys know how this works, right? I had no idea. You know, so every day you wake up, you're looking at yourself in the mirror, you're brushing your teeth in the morning, and I was just me. I'm just looking, it's just Brandon. So as I changed from a physical standpoint, I couldn't really tell. It was imperceptible change to me. And so I was absolutely okay with who I was as Brandon. I was cool with just being Brandon. And so comfortable and confident Brandon heads out and gets thrown into the nightmare known as sixth grade gym class as he heads into middle school. And you know what? I think you guys can all agree with me. There are few more socially terrifying places on planet Earth than sixth grade gym class. I mean, you got people like putting up like a wall of towels so they can change their shirt for fear of exposing themselves. No matter how stanky somebody is, they are not showering because nobody's going to see a part of my body. I mean, this is what's going on. You got people on every end of the spectrum in there, right? The sixth grade dude that matured early, he's got that sweet little wispy mustache. You know, and he used to be shaving, and then the rest of the guys are still talking like girls. You know, I mean, that's where I was on the end of that spectrum at this time. And so one day, I'm in there. You know, I'm confident, Brandon, right? I'm okay with me. And I'm in gym class, and I'm changing my shirt, and I got my shirt pulled up over my head. And while I got my shirt like that in that awkward position, this guy that I'd known for years says to me this. He says, "Man, you're fat." That's what he says. And as crazy as this sounds, it was truly a shocking moment for me. See, I had never considered anything like that. I had never thought to give myself a label like that. And then all of a sudden, it's like out there, right? He's spoken it, and it's bouncing around in my head, and then all of a sudden within me, there's like this shame rising up. And I'm looking in the mirror, and suddenly I'm not liking what I see, you know, because of what this guy has spoken to me. You know, so I wasn't just Brandon anymore. I wasn't just okay with being me. I was now fat. You know, I accepted the label that this kid gave me, and you know, I lived in it. And so I got the shirt still in my head, I'm silently crying, trying to wipe away the tears. But that's like the outside picture. That was nothing compared to like this inner wound that I had received in that moment. I took on the identity of that hurt. I accepted the label as fat, and it rocked my world. It really did. It rocked my world that moment. My confidence was shattered. I was no longer comfortable in my own skin. And so I started to become obsessed with what other people thought of me. That's what I was obsessed with. Oh, man, what do other people think of me? And so as a seventh grader, the next year, I was drinking Slim Fast shakes for breakfast every day. That's not really even healthy for like 12-year-olds. You know, I'm drinking Slim Fast shakes. By the time I was 13, I like am religiously in the gym, like working out all the time, anytime I can, because I convinced myself, man, if I can get big enough, I'll be good enough. And you know, my parents are right here. They are incredible Christian people. Always set a great example, took us to church. I was in church every time the doors were open. But you know what? I wasn't really worshiping in the altar of God. I was worshiping at the altar of self. And I was worshiping at the altar of sports and the gym because if I could get big enough, strong enough, fast enough, good enough at these things, then I could have value and I could have worth. And then I could erase the image of this chubby little sixth grader who I thought was such a loser. And you know what? I had no idea at the time, but I was living right in the middle of the wounded life. See, I was living in these wounds and living with this pain, and I was trying to find relief from the pain through what other people thought of me, through the praise of others. But no matter how good I did, no matter what other people said, it was never enough. I was never good enough. And you know, a lot of people don't even know this about me. I don't even know if my parents know this about me. When I was 17 years old, I was in high school. I actually lived in Louisville, just up the road. I was a part of the Louisville football fighting farmers, 6'5A. I was a captain of the football team. There were parts of the year that I started both ways as a defensive end, as a tight end. I had everything that I ever wanted. I was absolutely miserable playing. I didn't enjoy playing football at all. You know why? Because I was sick to my stomach before every game thinking, man, when I get out there, what if I mess something up? What if I miss this block? What if I miss this tackle? Then the 15,000 people that are watching this game, they're obviously just going to be watching me, and they're going to see every mistake I make down on that field, and then I'm not going to have value, and I'm not going to have worth anymore. That's what was going through my head. You know, at this time in my life, I failed to get my approval from God. I failed to find my identity in Jesus Christ, and I sinfully sought the approval of other people. And you know what that left me? It left me empty. It left me empty, and it left me gearing my life towards selfishness and narcissism and sinfulness. And that's where I was headed. You know, every single one of us has been hurt, haven't we? Every single one of us has been hurt in this world. You know, and I know some of you guys have been through much more intense hurt than what I just described going through. You know, some of you guys have experienced things like what Judah went through in his life. Judah was hurt by his dad, hurt by his family. He didn't know his worth. He didn't know his identity. I don't think Judah even understood why he was hurting so badly and why he was acting the way that he was acting. You know, we got people in this room right now who have experienced every kind of hurt, just horrific name-calling, rejection, divorce, hatred, racism, bullying, violence, lies, sexual, physical, emotional abuse, every other kind of hurt that we can think of. We got people in this room that have experienced it. And you know what? I think about Judah being born into that toxic family. And when I look at that story, my heart hurts for him. It really does. I look back at my little 11-year-old self. You know, that cute little chubby kid in the basketball uniform. My heart hurts for him. You know, I can look back, and that was a time in my life where I could literally see my innocence being destroyed. You know, right then and there. And I got to tell you guys, I am truly sorry. I am truly sorry for the pain and the hurt that you've experienced in this fallen world at the hands of broken people around you. I'm sorry about that, but I got to tell you this. We cannot allow these pain-inflicting circumstances to define who we are. And we cannot allow them to give us our worth or to destroy our worth. We can't. You cannot choose to stay stagnant in the wounded life. You know, Larry Crabb, that counselor that I talked about earlier, he says that when you're living in the wounded life, you become obsessed with the question, why? Why? Why did this happen to me? Why did God let this happen to me? You know, why do I feel this way? Why do I hurt so badly? Why do I keep falling flat on my face and failing? Why can't I move on? And you know what? We keep asking the question why because we don't want to admit to ourselves that we are out of control. We want to ask why because we want to put it anywhere else. We don't want to admit to ourselves that we can't do anything to save us. See, when we obsess over the question why, what we're doing is we're assuming that any of the hurt, any of the pain that we're experiencing, any of the bad in our life has got to be somebody else's fault. It's got to be his or hers or their. It's got to be their fault when you obsess over the question of why. And if that's where you are, if you think that everything that's wrong with your life is because of something that somebody else did, you know what? You're stuck. You can't do anything about that. You can't change the things that they've done or the things that they've said. You can't do it. And so the only option for you is to seek relief from the pain that you're experiencing. You know, Joseph became Judah's focus, didn't he? Judah told himself, it's because of Joseph that my dad hates me. It's because of Joseph's mom that my dad doesn't love my mom. And so he sought relief, didn't he? By trying to get rid of Joseph. But it didn't bring relief. It didn't bring relief. He sought relief in escape, in rebellion, in marrying a pagan woman, in sex with prostitutes, and none of that brought him any kind of relief. I got called fat by another 11-year-old kid. That's, you know what? I never hated that kid. I never held that against him, but you know what I did do? I accepted the label that he gave me, and I allowed that to hurt me. And because of the pain I was living in, I sought relief, and I sought relief in winning. I sought relief in being the best, and the biggest, and the strongest, and the funniest, and anything. I was like a chameleon. Anything I needed to do to gain the approval of other people. And you know what? All of that work I did, all that relief that I was seeking, none of it helped. None of it brought any relief. How about you guys? How about you guys? If you're living in the wounded life, who do you try to lay the blame for your life on? Who is it? Who is it that you try to lay the blame on in your life? You know, where is it that you go? How do you try to seek instant relief from the pain? Because I think as human beings, we try it all. Sex and drugs and alcohol, popularity, success, money, porn, achievement, perfection. We try all these things, but nothing works, does it? Nothing works. Now, I have a friend who grew up in this pretty tough, old school Christian environment. His dad was an old school Church of Christ preacher, and basically it was a rough upbringing for this guy. You know, he didn't get a lot of affection from his dad, and his dad kind of created the kind of environment where you're not allowed to talk about your feelings at all in this house. You know, that's not what men do. You know, they handle their own business. And so my friend is dealing with these issues. They're swirling around his head of worth and his identity. He's not getting love with from his dad. All of this stuff's boiling around inside of him. And he also knows, hey, I can't talk to anybody about this because, I mean, that would destroy my manhood. I can't speak to anybody about this. So he's got these deep wounds, and those wounds caused him pain. And so he started to try to self-medicate through alcohol. He started to drink alcohol, and this led to alcoholism. And I want to read you guys a part of an email that he wrote me when he finally started to understand the destructiveness of the wounded life. This is what he said. I never understood the word powerless until one Sunday morning I was staring at a bottle of vodka, and I told myself, I'm going to drink it, and there's nothing that I can do about it. For the first time in my life, I didn't think powerlessness. I felt powerlessness. I did not want to be there. I had never intended for it to get this bad. There was only one solution, and that was to admit not only my powerlessness over alcohol, but my powerlessness over sin. I cannot think my way out of this. I cannot do good my way out of this. Only Christ can bring me to God. I'd like to say that I had an aha moment, but my years of lying and recklessness exposed me. It was the best thing that could have happened to me at the time. Eventually, the reality that becoming fully truthful with my wife and kids was the only way to cross over, to be truthful to God. I needed to be powerless so that God could restore me. That's what he sent me in the email. You know, nothing we try on our own power can cover up the wounds that we carry, the wounds that we refuse to let heal. And I want you guys all to hear me. I want you to hear me. We are powerless. You are powerless to bring yourselves relief. True relief can only be found where my friend found it, and that's in surrendering to God and doing everything you can to walk with Jesus Christ. You know, Judah himself, he had an aha moment. Judah did. You know, something changed in Judah. You guys know his story doesn't end with Tamar. Somewhere between selling his brother into slavery and offering himself to random prostitutes on the side of the road, Judah came to the realization that none of this was bringing him any kind of release. It wasn't working. This wounded life that he was living in the middle of, it was destroying him. It was killing him. That's exactly what he was doing. See, he had allowed his life to be completely dictated by the hurts that other people had caused him. And you know what happened then? He became a hurter. He became a wounder. He became a destroyer of relationships. And unfortunately, it doesn't lay out for us exactly how this went down in Scripture, but somehow Judah finally understood that those hurts had corrupted his entire life, and he changed. He transforms right before our eyes, and we see just how dramatically he changed as we go to Genesis chapter 44. Genesis 44. So while Judah, and remember, just to kind of tell you where this is in the story, so while Judah's getting married, having kids, marrying his sons off, watching his sons die, impregnating one of his dead sons' wives and marrying her, while that's all going on for Judah, Joseph has become one of the most powerful men in Egypt, which at this time in human history is the most powerful country in the world. That is what has gone on here. And the Bible tells us that Joseph is second only to Pharaoh in power. And so we see that God had this huge, incredible plan. When his brother sold him into slavery, he was putting Joseph in the right place at the right time. And the reason that Joseph became so powerful is because Pharaoh had him interpret some dreams. And basically, you guys know the story. What the dream said is, hey, in Egypt and in the world, there's going to be these 7 years of plentiful harvest, and those are going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And so because the Egyptians knew this, they started preparing, and they stored up tons of grain in preparation for those years of famine. And so they had food. They had food to spare. And so they're the only people in the Middle East who have food, and everybody in the world at this time, the known world, is starting to come to them to buy food, to keep themselves alive. And so guess who comes knocking on Joseph's door, asking for food. His brothers show up. Now, Joseph recognizes them immediately, but they don't know who he is because he's all in his Egyptian official garb. I mean, they think he is long dead. And so they bow down before him right there, and they fulfill the prophecy that he had shared with them when they were children. And the story plays out. I think you guys know it. They go back and forth a couple times, going back to Jacob and where their family is, going back to Egypt. And finally, Joseph decides, you know what? I'm going to test these guys. So he gives them all this sack of grain, and he takes this silver cup and he puts it in the youngest son Benjamin's grain sack. And nobody knows about this. The brothers don't. So he sends them back to Jacob where they can feed the family and save everybody. And while they're a little ways out, Joseph says, "Hey, guards, go find those people, search their sacks, and see if they've stolen anything." And obviously we know what happens. They find the silver chalice in Benjamin's bag. They drag all the brothers back. They throw them down in front of Joseph. And Joseph says, "I'm going to keep this thief as my slave." And do you guys, have you ever thought about this? This is the perfect opportunity for the rest of the brothers. This is Benjamin, right? This is the youngest son. This is the full brother of Joseph. I bet he's the new favorite. I bet they kind of hate him and are kind of annoyed by him. This is the perfect moment. The other brothers can walk away, wash their hands of Benjamin, be done with him. I mean, Joseph has saved them the problem, but guess what happens? I want you to see what Judah says in Genesis 44. He says, "For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would come to my father.'" This is Judah who speaks this. Judah, the guy who sold his brother into slavery. The guy who's marrying Canaanites, the guy who's sleeping with prostitutes, this is who he is. He steps up and he offers himself in Benjamin's place, and Joseph immediately sees the change in his brother, and he tells him who he is, and he weeps, and he welcomes them to Egypt as his family. And for me, the biggest miracle of this story is the transformation that we see in the life of Judah. This is a man who is fully entrenched in the wounded life. He's caught up, just obsessed with all the things that had been done to him. That's what he was obsessed over. He was bent on finding relief by the approval of others, by rebellion, by living for himself. And he sees the emptiness of the wounded life, and he transitions into something that I call the resurrection life. Now, Joseph came back from the dead, at least from his brothers thinking that he was dead. But for me, Judah is the real picture of coming back from death, because he is coming back from spiritual death. That's what we see. He realizes that there can be life after pain. He realizes that there can be life after hurt if he offers himself fully to God. That's the resurrection life right there. You know, it wasn't until my freshman year of college when I started to see the emptiness of the wounded life, when I started to understand that I could never be fulfilled by the opinions and the approval of other people. It was never enough. I always needed more. I always needed more. And so I started to transition from blaming others and worshiping myself into offering my life over to God and into following Jesus Christ. And I still struggle. I'll be the first to tell you guys. You know, I still find myself seeking quick relief sometimes, trying to find my worth in what other people think of me. But slowly, step by step, God is bringing me out of the grave, and he's bringing me into the resurrection life. And I just want you to hear that the resurrection life is waiting for every single one of us. Now, there was this study mentioned in the book called The Grave Robber by Mark Batterson, and this study was conducted in 2004, and basically they got this elite team of medical researchers and practitioners together. They locked them in this room at a hotel for a couple days, and they started just looking at all this information, all the information they could find. They were trying to solve the American healthcare crisis. That's what they were trying to do. And so after days and days and hours of study, they found from their research that 80% of the health problems in the United States of America could be solved if people made 5 changes to behavioral things that were going on in their lives. If they changed 5 things: too much eating, too much drinking, smoking, stress, and not enough exercise. Those are the 5 behavioral things that led to 80% of the healthcare issues going on in the United States of America. And with a few minor changes, they could solve the healthcare crisis. That's what they found. But here's the kicker. See, there was encouraging news, but it was also very discouraging, because the kicker is nobody wants to change. Nobody wants to change. As an example, they threw out this one study where they found that people who had coronary bypass surgeries, if they went to them 2 years after the surgery, they found out that 90% of them had changed absolutely nothing about the way that they lived their lives. Now, if you're looking just at those numbers, according to those numbers, 9 out of 10 people would rather die than change. That's crazy. And I think this brings us to the real question of the day. The question for you and I, do you want to get better? That's the question. Do you want to get better? I'm not trying to belittle or minimize anything that you've gone through, but the only person that you are hurting by continuing to live in the wounded life is you. Are you willing to work towards change? Are you willing to work towards letting those wounds that are inside your heart, are you willing to work towards letting those heal? Are you willing to allow Jesus Christ to give you your identity and to give you your worth? You know, I know we're a room full of Christians, but I know so many Christians who do not allow Jesus Christ to give them their worth. He has said to you through his message on the cross that you are worth dying for. Do you believe that? Do you believe that? Are you willing to admit to yourself that you cannot save yourself, you cannot self-medicate through sin, you cannot find relief on your own? The wounded life is a life of emptiness and pain, and the resurrection life is one of peace and joy. And the question is, which one are you going to seek out? Which one are you going to seek out? You know, one of my favorite passages from the book of Romans, I think, really sums up the resurrection life for us. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we shall certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. We know that our old self was crucified with him in order that the body of sin might be brought to nothing, so that we would no longer be enslaved to sin. For one who has died has been set free from sin. Now, if we have died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him. We know that Christ, being raised from the dead, will never die again. Death no longer has dominion over him, for the death he died to sin once for all, but the life he lives to God. So you also must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus. If we believe, this is a room full of Christian people, if we believe that Jesus Christ has died for our sins, if we have placed our faith in him, this passage says that we have been united in his death. We have been united in his death. And that death, you know what that death does? That brings an end to our sin. But you know what? There's another part to it. That death also brings an end to the sins that have been committed against you. Do you hear that? That death also brings an end to the sins that have been committed against you. We are freed through Jesus' sacrifice on the cross to walk in the resurrected life. We've been set free. Believe that and seek out the resurrected life.